Our bird numbers were down 50% compared to last year. I didn't think we could have a season hotter than the fall of 24. It was boiling. I still feel like it must have had an impact on our birds. It must have killed some adults. Do we believe in the cycle anymore?
Yeah, it is. It seems like just kind of all over the place, especially
snow death's a much bigger factor than maybe I gave it credit. You get a couple really hard winters of deep, fluffy snow, the next couple seasons seem to be pretty darn good. Our birds have had roosting snow since Thanksgiving weekend, so I'm optimistic.
Bird numbers were down, so you experienced some of what we had in Minnesota.
The ratio of adults was higher than young birds.
Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. All right, welcome back to another episode of Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Today, I'm excited to be joined once again by my friend Fritz Heller from Michigan. I got to be honest, buddy, thank you for joining us today. But when you texted me yesterday, I quickly turned my phone down. I thought you may have been texting me about Mr. Quinn Hughes and the Minnesota Wild. And I do my best to avoid my phone because my buddy Jerry likes to spoil the games for me. I always watch him later, but you were not texting about that. You were just checking in about the show.
That's all I was checking in about. I was hopeful the Red Wings might. Garen paid a big price for that one, and he seems to be in all-in mode now. So yeah, but at least the Red Wings are competitive and seem to have it going this year a little bit.
Yeah, I know you're plenty busy with other hockey-related stuff, which maybe we can touch on, but I got to be honest, like I follow the league closely enough to know of the Hughes brothers and what the reputation that precedes them. As a Michigan guy, are they like, I mean, kind of top of the charts for like fodder and people paying attention? I mean, what can you tell me about them?
The Hughes brothers are always on the mind of Red Wings fans because they played at the National Development Program down in Plymouth and then all went to the University of Michigan for a season or two before they went on to the league. We're part of some really good University of Michigan teams. So, of course, you know, there's always that connection back to Detroit in the greater Detroit area. And if the Wings were ever to have them, not to mention they're really, really good hockey players. Not a lot of families with three brothers in the NHL right now.
I mean, it's pretty, and they're all drafted in the first round. Like, I've learned a lot more about him just reading stuff over the last weekend after Quinn Hughes was traded to the Wild, but I did not know, like, the Red Wings could have drafted him. They passed him over, and yeah.
The guy they picked, I forget who they picked right ahead of him.
I read his name yesterday, but it was, like, not anybody you've heard of as much as Quinn Hughes.
Yeah, he washed out.
Gosh, that's a bummer. I mean, that's part of the game, but in hindsight, it's always 20/20. But yeah, I was, as a Wild fan, I mean, again, he plays in the West. Like, I've seen him and I hear people talk about him, but I wasn't against the trade. The Wild paid a huge price, and this Z Booyam kid looks like he's going to be something. So it was tough to see him go. But after watching Quinn Hughes one game last night, I think a lot of questions were answered last night. He looked pretty slick out there.
He's arguably the second best offensive defenseman in the world after Cale Makar. So you just added potentially, you know, a top five defenseman in the world to your roster. So,
you know, a lot of times you look at the player and what you gave up and stuff, but the subtle changes that adding a guy to the top of your depth chart, what that does for everybody else in the lineup and how everybody else slots in. It's pretty exciting to be a Wild fan today. We'll see how it shakes out, but it's going to be fun. But aside from that, We're here to talk birds and grouse and dogs. So I know you can see the snow behind me. You guys are covered up this year too, right?
I ran home mid-morning today to let the dogs out and make some business phone calls and just kind of get out of the office for a minute. Normally I do that right around lunchtime, but with my appointment with you today, I had to do it a little bit early. But my wife's bird bath that sits out towards the end of our driveway in her fenced-in enclosure flower garden, whatever she does out there. It's a deer-free zone, too. I built a very nice fence. By that, I mean I built a fence, and it keeps the deer out. 30 inches sitting on top of that bird bath. So we've been pretty much pounded since Thanksgiving with snow very consistently, and the lake effect machine's working. We need it. We've had 3 mild winters in a row. So it just benefits the environment so much in so many different ways. Our lake levels have been dropping really fast, which is kind of scary. We're probably below average now, considering in 2020, we were way above average. So the lake that Carrie and I have a place on is 100% spring fed. So as that lake rises and falls, almost in correlation with it, and you know, there's 12 feet of beach in front of my break wall, so to speak, that wasn't there just 5 years ago. Does make getting the dock in and out easier. But right now, our birds had roosting snow since Thanksgiving weekend. And you can go back to your season in Minnesota, two or three, 4 years ago, that came off of 2 winters where you guys had roosting snow for 4 or 5 months. And then you saw the impact on how the birds reproduce the following springs. So I'm optimistic. I know it's really healthy for the environment, both our water levels and for the rough grouse we love so much.
I would agree. Obviously, very similar storyline over here. And I chatted with our mutual buddy, Dell Whitman, I think last week, and he had told me you guys were, the lake effect was really going. I mean, we have a bunch of snow over here, but not quite that much. Have the cold temps broke for you yet, or you might be a day late, I'm guessing?
No, they haven't. They're forecasting some highs in the upper 30s starting Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, maybe a little bit tomorrow. I was starting to get excited that maybe we would get enough runoff to go steelhead fishing. Maybe we get a push of fish, but it still looks like it's going to be like a high of 37 and a low of 17.
I'm the non-steelhead guy, but what are you looking for?
Oh, put a bunch of water into the river.
Okay.
Yeah. Just raise the river.
Need like a couple of days of melt or something?
You would really need at least 48 hours of above freezing temperatures to make an impact on this. I mean, it's been unseasonably cold. We normally get November storms and early December storms, and then we get a thaw, right? Where there hasn't been. It just turned to winter on Thanksgiving and has been winter ever since, including the temperatures. We're not getting, you know, a high of 35, but it's just stayed winter, you know. I mean, it was 8 yesterday. Saturday morning was our duck opener split, and we thought about it, but then all our lakes are froze. They're ice fishing everywhere here. This is the earliest they've been ice fishing in a long time here. And our lakes are froze, and 8 degrees doesn't sound like a fun day of duck hunting.
Early morning, cold water, 8 degree air temps. Yeah. You'd have to really want to get out there.
Right. And then to get a drift boat into some of our launches, you know, I don't know if I would have to call our local biologist and see if the DNR guy's been plowing our launches or not. So Maybe we'll get a thaw. We'll see. Doesn't feel like it's coming, which is fine. It can just stay winter till March 15th.
It's kind of one of those things where, yeah, we've been, you know, it's like, depends on how you look at it, right? The what the birds need and what the late season grouse hunter wants are oftentimes two different things. And, you know, it's hard to strike the balance, but the last couple of years have been, they really are the exception to the norm, but we have flirted with like snow-free conditions right up until the end of the season. And I've certainly enjoyed that. So this year was a stark contrast to that, but this is not totally unusual, with the exception that what you said is, you know, November was so mild up until we got that storm right before Thanksgiving, and the temperature dropped below freezing, and it has not been above freezing since that day. Tomorrow is supposed to be 43 degrees here, or maybe 40 degrees. That'll be the first time we're above freezing since then, which is quite unusual to have it stay that low that long. But again, the snow conditions were really good for these cold temps.
I pulled up my my Facebook memories just this morning, and there's a picture from 2 years ago, and it's titled December Days and October Temperatures with a dog and a gun and a big red face. So, I mean, there's not a chance I could hunt right now. I even looked at the snow map to see if there's other areas I could, you know, maybe sneak out. Sometimes along our lake shore, you can get some less snow, or if you can drive east, there's not there. But, you know, to go back to talking about Dell, it is his time of the season, right? Being an elf-sized human.
Yeah, he's out there post-hauling.
But the last day I hunted with a buddy who actually is moving to Duluth right now, and we hunted the last day of our season. It was 64 degrees.
Was that the Monday before Thanksgiving?
No, our season ends November 14th because we closed for deer season.
Yeah. So, yeah, you haven't been out post deer season or anything. Yeah.
It's been a long time since I haven't gotten any late season hunting in.
So, with the 37 degrees, you're not tempted at all just because of the snow depth?
I don't think we're going to lose enough snow to even make it possible or comfortable. I mean, they're grooming snowmobile trails. I'm not sure you could. So much of our access is two tracks, which are really old logging roads, and then they become our snowmobile trail system in the winter. And they've been grooming snowmobile trails for 2.5-3 weeks now.
I'm thinking about it just because, I mean, I can get to a place tomorrow. Is like,
yeah,
it's like it's gonna rise up and then it's gonna dip back down, which. Kind of like I'm hopeful that, I mean, 40, if it does get to 40 degrees, I mean, it might only be for a few hours. I don't know. I mean, hopefully it doesn't deteriorate the snow too much, because then it does look like it's going to cool right back down, or at least we get some more. But I am considering ceremonially hitting the woods tomorrow just because it looks like it's going to be breezy, but it'll be warm. And I don't know what kind of, I'll have to check the snow depths. Where do you go to look at snow depths? I just Google a snow depth map every once in a while.
I'll text you the map that I use.
Okay. And I'm asking because I haven't found a great one.
Pretty accurate. My friend Bob Wheelock sourced it, and it's programmed on my phone, but it's a NOAA map that gives you snow depths across, you know, kind of your state. And I found it to be very, very accurate.
And that's the other thing too. I do pay attention to that, because this time of year you might get snow in one place but not universally, but really that first storm that came through just kind of covered everybody up past that, you know, 1 to 2 inch mark, and it hasn't changed a whole lot. Bob Wheelock, I feel like I know that name, maybe you're just from Facebook or something, but would I know him from anywhere else?
Bob Wheelock is a American field cover dog trialer amateur that's had a ton of success. He's been president of a number of clubs over here at the Gladwin Field Trial Grounds, and has wonderful English setters, has a litter every now and then. He's just a great guy. We play a little golf in the summer and hang out in the fall a little bit, but he's had a lot of success on the cover dog circuit. Very intelligent guy.
I mean, take me back a little bit through the season. What was kind of the story of the season for you? Well, I want to talk about the dogs and the puppies and stuff, but just from a rough grouse hunting perspective, you know, up until that Thanksgiving storm, how were things for you guys? I know there was the ice storm. I'd be curious to what you guys experienced with that as well.
Yeah, so I was really optimistic that we were going to have a good season because our spring nesting conditions felt really, really good. And we had the right amount of summer rains. We actually, in my area, did not have a drought until about mid-August. And then the drought came on really strong, and it barely rained until maybe mid-November. And then opening day, Rick and I went out, and we moved more birds opening day than we've moved in 4 or 5 years. But the theme of this season was, I didn't think we could have a season hotter than the fall of 24. I was wrong. It was boiling all season long. It was uncomfortable. Even in the mornings, you're getting up, it's 55 degrees. You get in maybe an hour and a half on the ground, and that's getting up early. I don't like hunting rough grouse at daylight, but if you want to go with the temperatures we had, you really didn't have a choice. And then by 10 a.m., it's 70 degrees out already, and it's 80 degrees in the afternoon. And I lost more days to heat this year than I've ever lost ever. It was not even like you'd get like, okay, we're going to have a week of really warm temps, or by Thursday, it's going to be a high of 62, you know, that's September, early October stuff now. So it was really hot. And I think our bird numbers, I was very optimistic, and I thought, I'm not going to make any judgments. People kept asking me, how are bird numbers? How are bird numbers? And once it cooled, I said, I don't know, because until it cools down, it's going to be hard to tell. So once it did cool down, I felt like our leaf drop was kind of on schedule. We had a pretty nice color season if you're in the tourism business. But I thought, okay, here we go. We got some mid-October rain. Then it kind of normalized temperature-wise towards the end of October. And I believe our bird numbers were down when I finally really got to put in a ton of effort. Our bird numbers were down 50% compared to last year. So I take Fridays off during the fall. And last year, if I was hunting alone, and I'm going to call like a full day on the ground, you know, 4 to 5 hours of actual boots on the ground. And I was pushing, you know, 15 to 20 birds alone. This year, I was struggling to get to, you know, and then if I had a partner with me, you know, you're going to move more birds, especially in the flushing dog business. You're just cutting a little bit bigger swath. And if I had a partner with me, you know, we were moving 20 to 30 birds in a really good condition day. And then, you know, my after work hunts where sometimes you move a dozen, sometimes you move four, but real effort figuring out where they're at, where they're living. I was struggling to get to 10 or 11. And when I hunted with a partner, it was like I was struggling to get to a dozen. And so that was, they got to be down 50%. Now the ice storm hit one of the areas I hunt pretty consistently, and I never went over there this year because of it. But I do believe it had to have impacted our hatch. I don't know any other way to put it. And then I go, well, still in my harvest, I'm guessing I was shooting 85% of this year's birds for the season. And so we had a nest, but I'm thinking that that ice storm really did an impact on some adult birds, even though in my core, say 120 mile radius that I hunt, unless I'm traveling or taking a week off, we didn't have the trees breaking over. We didn't have that kind of business like they did more in the Pigeon River area, more kind of Gaylor Grayling, a little bit northwest and northeast. And I still feel like that was an April storm. Yeah, I still feel like it. It was early April. I still feel like it must have had an impact on our birds. It must have killed some adults. That's how I feel. So overall, the season, the theme was, I wish I had a better answer, was it was really, really hot. And then I complained a lot. My wife's like, well, maybe December. And then we kept hearing, oh, the Great Lakes are really, really warm. We're expecting a big winter. Maybe you'll get to go in December. Because I was just complaining that I didn't get to go as much as I wanted to. And then we get into, you know, now we're snowed out. But it was down, just down, you know, 50% down. Now, I'm optimistic that this weather is going to help us in a good spring. Like we've chatted in the past, still everywhere I go, there's a lot of habitat that's a little too old and a little too young. Some of that little too young is starting to really come into its own now. So that was my season. How about you guys over there? Some of my friends over there. I was over there for about 3 days picking up a puppy, and it was really hot.
That was early, like early October, maybe?
Yeah, I was there early October. The first 3 days of October, maybe. And I found some birds, but again, I couldn't give much effort. Now, when I was there, the birds I killed seemed a little bit, the ratio of adults was higher than young birds compared to years past.
I would say that tracks. And so did you not do like your week trip this year?
We did not do our week trip because of this sport that I love and coach. So my son is a senior, and as I was telling you, he played fall hockey out of town. And I just didn't line up with kids' activities and everything. And we took a week off, and then, or we did not make our annual trip this year. You know, I got two new puppies this fall. Not that they couldn't go on that week trip or anything, but and then I had plans in November to take like 2 5-day stretches off. And one of them was a wash because of heat. I didn't, you know, I hunted close to home a little bit, but my plan was to get on the road for that. Didn't do it. At that point, I didn't even care what bird numbers were. I just wanted to go walk and see what I could find. And I took the second stretch off, but then we got a snowstorm. I don't know, November 8th or 9th came in. And actually had pretty good hunting the day that snow came in. That was my best day all season, as a matter of fact. And then it melted off right away, and I put in a lot of effort that last week of our season, a lot of effort. I drove, I stayed close to home, I drove again, and just never could really put together any consistency. So it sounds like that was kind of the case for the most part across all three Great Lakes states.
A lot of what you said definitely kind of rings true. What I saw, experienced, I probably shared tidbits throughout the fall on the podcast and stuff, but very, very similar. You know, I kept saying, man, it's been such a slow progression into the primetime conditions. It was an elevated temperature. We didn't have a frost until like I did my annual grouse camp, which is like the right after Halloween. We do that. It was like, we didn't have a frost until then. And so, I mean, for me, I had a really good run in November. And if it weren't for like that last week of October and then the couple 2-3 weeks in November that I got to get out and get after it, really like put forth the effort that you're talking about, like where you can actually do so under those conditions. I mean, the season would have felt pretty off to me if I didn't get that. But I mean, we took advantage of the window that we had, and then it just, the switch flipped and it was just lights out basically.
You know, our ducks didn't even show up until really late. It, you know, normally we get that cold snap in November, we get a storm in late October or something, and we start to get, you know, some ducks in. And not that I spend a ton of time duck hunting, I just pay attention to it. Our ducks never showed up until Thanksgiving, really. I mean, because it never was cold, you know. But didn't get a trip, but that's going to change for me in the future. So
bird numbers were down. Now that was the reason I was going to ask about your trip, because you've typically take a trip over here. So you experienced some of what we had in Minnesota in 2023, last year was pretty darn good.
Way 2022 was really good too.
It was
2022 was really good too.
We had a good run, and again this year just really highlights, kind of like punctuates how good they were, because like you, it didn't feel like there was any real extreme conditions that would have affected the hatch. And the drumming counts told us that, you know, adult survival was down a little bit last winter. We didn't have a lot of snow, more cold, not nearly as good of a winter as 23 was. So you're expecting a little bit there, but then from a summer hatch perspective, there was nothing super alarming, I guess, to me. But when we got out there this fall, it was just, you know, part of it was that early, you can't really put forth the effort to really get a sense of what's going on out there. But now looking back, I mean, it was so hit and miss. There was like, of all the different areas that I hunt, there was one area that I would say was like above average this year. And that was a kind of a nice thing to find. So I did focus on that later in the season before we got the snow, and I had some of my best hunts there. And again, that kind of really made the season for us. But outside of that, it was places that we were moving, you know, 15 to 30 birds a year or two ago. I mean, you might go in there and flush six or something. It was not on the same level. And I mean, that's going to happen with rough grouse. You've been doing it long enough to know that, but you're always trying to, you're looking at the weather and things and trying to put the pieces together. But I don't know. It was a strange season.
Do we believe in the cycle anymore? Because if we believe in the cycle, we were due for this. But if you don't believe in the cycle anymore, then, you know, it's a little confusing, right?
It seems like just kind of all over the place, especially in the last, I mean, almost 10 years. It was 17. 2017, I think, was the big West Nile scare, right? And then ever since then, we kind of climbed out of it and obviously had a really, really good run here the last couple of years. And I think it's, yeah, historically, it's like the years that end in 4 and 5 are kind of the low end of the cycle, and 0 and 1 are the top. But yeah, the cycle is an odd one.
It's for us. My best seasons have always ended in a 3. But I can also tell you by my notes that those seasons, we also had really good winter conditions, and it correlates to my steelheading too. You know, my steelheading always, when I'm having a good steelhead season or conditions are good for steelhead, it seems like it's very good for grouse that fall also.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's everything to do with snow depth. I mean, in my opinion, it feels like snow depth's a much bigger factor than maybe I gave it credit when I was younger. But if I really look back at those snow depth years, you get a couple really hard winters of deep, fluffy snow. The next couple seasons seem to be pretty darn good.
Yep. At this point, I'm with you. Even if whether or not I do get that ceremonial hunt in tomorrow, it might as well just keep snowing, because I will happily bust out the cross country skis and just ski through the grouse woods, if nothing else.
You know, we had a huge soft mast year, and I was very excited. Yeah, I was excited because there's nothing more fun in November when all the leaves are down and you can look out on a landscape and a big stem density plot and find those giant oaks that still have those red brown leaves on them and just start walking towards those. Our acorn crop was huge. Our dogwood crop was good. Our apples were good. The only thing that was not good this year at all was our pincherries and our blackberries raspberry crop. We had no blackberry raspberry crop. You know, and those are both species that, you know, the blackberry and the raspberry offer a lot of secondary canopy and a lot of ground cover, whether they've got fruit on them or not. But those are also very good early season. You know, the pincherries drop in September sometimes, and we didn't have any pincherries. We didn't have any raspberry or blackberries. My wife normally picks enough blackberries, wild blackberries, to do some jam, and she didn't pick any this year. She normally doesn't need to leave our yard, and we had none. But, and then she asked me, are you finding any spots with blackberries in them? I go, no, there's none.
Those raspberry patches, I mean, those always, they're just, it's like one of the first things to come up in the young cuts. And I just imagine, you know, sunlight pouring in there all summer, the raspberry patches, and the birds are using that. I mean, that's definitely an area of focus. Like you said, whether there's fruit there or not, you just know the birds are hanging around that stuff.
Right. And I'm guessing that that April ice storm heavy probably did in though that early soft mast for us, versus the stuff that bloomed later had really nice bloom conditions and consistent water this summer.
All right, I want to talk puppies, but before we go there, do you have a bird at the taxidermist now? We were chatting about that a little bit.
I guess when I was my wife gets frustrated because when I go out and things and conditions are right and I'm not successful, then I get frustrated because I start to worry about the resource. And she's like, well, I was at work today. I just don't think you'll ever understand, honey. It's like, she wonders why I get in a bad mood when when the girls don't play good in a hockey game. And I'm frustrated at the end of that. It's kind of the same thing. But so, if anything, I'll remember this season for a long time because of one day. So Rick and I had a litter of puppies 15 years ago this May. And my old dog's name is May. And she is left out of the litter of 7. And my parents have a dog named Wolf that I hunted over for years and Wolfie is still alive, but I don't know if I was being sentimental or if it had to do with losing Pippa last spring. May's 14 and a half years old. She still runs around pretty darn well. She was retrieving ducks last year, breaking ice. But she can't, her hearing's not good and her heat tolerance with most old dogs isn't good. But I had a day where I loaded the other dogs in the truck and she just kind of looked at me. And so I picked her up and put her in and I just said, all right, today's the day. And I texted Carrie and her, I said, I'm taking May. So if you come home at lunch or I don't know, she might've been off that day. I said, that's why May is not asleep and on her bed in the corner of our room, which seems to sleep about 22 hours a day right now. And I just loaded her up and I said, I'm going to go into like 20 minute spots. And, she flushed a bird in our first spot that I couldn't get drawn on. And then the second spot, I took her down there and she got birdie and was on a track. And I hustled down to the end of this kind of strip of aspen down along some cedars in a creek, and a great big bird went out and I shot and broke a wing and it went down in the swamp. And I was starting to debate whether I was going to go get a younger dog at that point or not. And we walked down there and she got birdie and that bird hopped up over a log and I told her to sit, and she sat and I grabbed the bird and gracefully squeezed the life out of the bird. And then we turned and walked back to the truck, and then her and I took some pictures, and her and I sat on the tailgate and I had a nice cry. I debated on letting her retrieve that bird or not, and I kind of had an idea when it went up that it was a big mature bird, and it was. And so I didn't let her retrieve it just to make sure that I had a pristine specimen to go to the taxidermist. And it's just it's wild to me to think that I killed a rough grouse over her every season for 15 straight years. You know, I might not ever have a run of that, but I've made it kind of a tradition that, you know, when I get down to that last bird or one of those last birds, that if I get the right one, I've gotten it mounted. So I was able to, I have a grouse I shot over all of my dogs that have passed except for Pippa that we lost last spring mounted. And so I'm excited to have it. I like taxidermy. I would say I'm more of a give me a memorable taxidermy bird. You know, I've got a wild bobwhite quail that I shot a long time ago in southern Michigan mounted. I've got two rough grouse already mounted that I shot over two previous dogs. I've got a Michigan sharptail that I have mounted, and then I have two wild Michigan roosters that I killed in 2013 off the farm my mom grew up on in very southern Michigan. And so those are all kind of memory birds. And then I've got a couple ducks that I've killed at our lake house. When we first bought the place, we closed on it late in the summer. And so we started duck hunting there, and I shot a giant triple curl mallard, just a massive one. So I've got the first mallard I shot on the lake, and then May 2 years ago retrieved a great big black duck that I killed at the lake. And I'm not a huge duck hunter, but I think black ducks are really, really cool. And Meadow did the mount for me on that one and did just an amazing job. And so overnight air makes, you know, those things possible. And so yeah, that's my taxidermy collection. I got kind of the Michigan Grand Slam of upland birds done, which is pretty awesome. The likelihood of somebody killing a wild bobwhite quail again is pretty slim in Michigan. unless you got a lot of money and a lot of want to just create habitat. But yeah, so that was May's last bird, and you know, all 15 years of memories pour back, and all the out of state trips and every place you've been. But she's still kicking.
15 years, man. That's I got a friend of mine has got a 15 year old dog, and she's had one heck of a run too. The listeners will know Hartley's 11. So I mean, again, yeah, it's just something you start to think about. And well, I shared that on the podcast. I was talking about all this sort of like what are the boxes you got to check to, and I don't have any birds mounted. So there's a little bit of a hurdle for me to say like, okay, I'm going to get the first one mounted, and I probably should. There's two birds now. I have their fans here in the office that I kind of regret not mounting, but it's, you know, I got the memories, right? Like you have it, but it'll happen at some point. And there was one that came close, but I didn't make a good enough shot on it. And then it required a little recovery from Hartley. So we lost a few too many feathers. But I had a bunch of people, including you, reach out and kind of say, share their stories, similar things that they've done with their dogs to kind of commemorate that. And it's just, it's neat when you get the right bird. You know, I don't know if there was any other, like, obviously you could tell it was a bigger, mature bird. I mean, I think you kind of have that in mind. Anything else that you, do you have a color phase or anything that you really like, or?
No, I don't have a specific color. I mean, someday I want to get one of those great big copper red ones mounted, just because they're pretty unique and awesome. And you get more of them over by you than I get in my area. We get pretty traditionally intermediate phase and gray phase. This is just a great big kind of light gray phase bird, you know, with a big full tail fan and with just a broken wing, is in pristine condition. So it'll make a really nice mount. What I was thinking back on is I can remember the last bird I killed over Bella. I can remember the last bird I killed over Hildy, and somehow I think the grouse gods shine on my old dogs and my shooting ability, because had I missed that bird, I don't know if we'd be having this same conversation, or I don't know if I would have taken her back out. But for some reason, I've killed the, you know, kind of the last finds, the last birds they found. Like I said, it must be the grouse god smiling on me that I'm able to like connect on the shot. And I remember that was a hard shot. It was flying, you know, kind of quartering down and away from me into the cedars by the time I kind of pulled the trigger, and just to be able to get a wing. I didn't have a lot of time on that one. It wasn't one of those birds that was rising up on a 45 or even out from you. It was a kind of a going away down the hill shot, which we don't shoot a lot. You know, we don't get those looks a lot. So it's just fascinating that for some reason I've always been able to connect on some of those.
Do the birds go at the cottage, or do you have a place at home for them?
I've got two places. So the waterfowl's at the lake. I'll put this bird at the lake because we kind of bought the lake house when May was pretty young and a puppy. So she spent a lot of her life there. And then I have down in my basement, I've got a bit of a man cave, you know, with my den. And, you know, but kind of the living room down there has got artwork and mounts and, you know, pictures framed of memories and such. So that, you know, I was down there watching the Lions lose yesterday, and it's, you know, kind of set up. So I have a new office. I have windows.
Yeah, I was gonna say it looks a little different than the last time I had.
Yeah, I have windows for the first time in my life in my office. So I'm still working on deciding what I'm gonna put here. I don't think I'll put any taxidermy here. But, you know, I've got a bunch of photos and stuff. I just need to get it hung up.
Where is the, you want to shout out to any taxidermy shops where there's Meadow doing this one?
Are you there, Nick? You just froze on me.
Oh, yeah, I'm still here.
There's a award-winning taxidermist down south of me in Miesic, Michigan, named Jonathan Wright at Thundering Aspens. They run a really, really nice shooting preserve. They do dog trainings, the three Wright brothers, and Jonathan's a world-class taxidermist. So I dropped it off down there. I know Meadow said she's not taking any more birds right now, or I might have overnighted it to her, but it's pick the person you want. I do need to decide. I like grouse that are standing kind of mounts, but this one I think I'm going to do flying, just because that, just to same way I've got the ducks done for the lake house, and I think I'm gonna put this one at the lake. So I gotta decide on a pose, and but you know, it's gonna take 2 years to get it back.
I'm glad you mentioned the pose, because I was gonna ask you, but I was thinking about this yesterday, I think. And when I was growing up, I too love standing grouse. There's just something about a grouse, like standing. They're just so cool looking. But like, I used to always think I want a grouse mounted that way. And I think, like, cause I used to shoot a lot of them standing. I don't think you were the same way. I don't think you've shot as many standing grouse as I have, but I think if I were to do it now, it'd be a wing bird.
Big Rick's rules and procedures, you know, we weren't allowed to kill a lot of game birds that were standing still.
Yeah, I always remember you talking about, like, your dad's like gave you one, and yep, that was it.
You get one.
Yeah, you get, and Harry one. Got his, right?
He got one, and then he hasn't killed one off a limb yet. So
okay, but has he had enough time to tag along with you? Or is, I know he's super busy
he's,
with hockey.
He's super busy. So he got to hunt a couple days this year, and maybe would debate me on whether he killed that bird there in mid-November. I call mid-November, but I'm talking the middle part of our November season. So sometime at weekend in November, he might debate on me whether he got that one or I got it. He did some missing that day. He did shoot a great big banded goose, though. Yeah, we got, after it snowed, and I went out hunting with another buddy of mine and Harrison's buddy, and another father-son duo. We really had a nice day, and then had lunch. And then I was like, oh boy, there's still some chores at the cottage. So two 17-year-olds, we got to go get this done. And they're like, Dad, there's a dozen geese down on the beach. And I'm like, well, you guys are wearing blaze orange. There's not really a really good sneak attack. They're like, we're just going to charge them. So I handed them each 6 waterfowl shells, and they went down there and got themselves a couple big Canadas, and one was banded. So that, I mean, that was pretty cool that day. But he's so busy with playing hockey right now that he just doesn't get an opportunity to go as much. And then when he did have opportunities, again, back to this season, it was so hot that, you know, we weren't going anyway.
My boys joined me for a number of days. Like, I mean, we continue the thread, right? Like, get them out and get them exposed. But my older son Hunter, we've gotten accustomed to like getting some pretty good late season days, and again with the favorable conditions the last couple of years, but that ended so quickly this year. We didn't get as many as I would have liked, but we had some good family cabin weekends as well. So
is he walking with you, or is he still on his bike?
So this year he was hiking, and the younger one, Jack, is 4 now, so he's on the bike. Hunter was hiking mostly this year. We didn't do many bike hunts, but the bike is still it's a good hack for young hunters. If you want to get them out there, they can cover some ground that way.
My brother's got a real quick, just to wrap up with kids. My brother's 11-year-old killed his first ever grouse on the wing this year. It was a great big monster. And that kid is a carbon copy of what Rick and I were when we were little. He probably hooked 25 steelhead on his own last spring. He's crazy for fishing. He's crazy for hunting. And so I was really happy for him. That one's at the taxidermist too.
Excellent. Yeah, I suppose you got to do that. Let's talk dogs here. You got 2 new puppies. I mean, you're the Flushing dog guy, at least as far as frequent guests go. I'd love to just hear about the new dogs you got, and then kind of talk about like that first season, and maybe, you know, maybe there it was a bit underwhelming just given the conditions and stuff, but I don't know if there'll be any lasting effects. You feel like you didn't get the pups into enough birds, but talk me through puppy season.
This wasn't really their puppy season because I picked them up in October. So they're just 4.5 months old right now, 4.5 pushing 5 months old right now. But last spring when we got home from spring break, I used a dog trainer buddy of mine that takes the dogs when I go on extended vacation. And it's awesome because, you know, one, I know they're secure. 2, he's exercising them every day. And when I picked up, he's like, you know, I've had Labradors my whole life. And then I've had Pippa, the American Cocker Spaniel, that people affectionately nicknamed her the Grouse Cat. And Pippa, Pippa got a really aggressive thyroid cancer that grew extremely fast. So we lost her just shy of her 10th birthday this spring. And I have not lost one young in a really long time. I mean, somehow my Labradors have all made 14, and two of them now look like they're going to make 15. And so losing them young seems to take a little bit more of a toll. It took a more of a toll on me than I anticipated. I mean, I was fully expecting her to hunt for two or three more seasons, and that left kind of a hole in the program. And so I lost her, and my wife pushed immediately to get another one because we don't know how much longer my 14 and a half, 15 year old's going to be with us. And that left me down to a 10 year old and a 6 year old. And I was planning on probably next season. I was going to wait till May passed to get another one. And then my wife's like, "Hey, let's go, buddy." And so I started doing my research, and I'm always kind of watching. I feel like I'm an athletic director that's, got a list of replacement candidates in case my head coach leaves. And so I found what I wanted, very similar blood to what Rick and I have had for a long time. The right dog's up close. So I put a deposit down on a Labrador Retriever. And then I got a phone call from the lady that I bought my American Cocker from. And from my research and estimation and talking to people, there's about three lines of true field American Cockers left in the country, really. And I'm sure I might have just upset somebody, but I wanted something really close to what I had. The more I thought, I can't imagine not having one. My first American Cocker had more fun hunting than any dog I've ever owned. So she called and said, "Hey, I know of a really, really, really good litter. And I can get your name on the list if you'd like." And I said, "Well, I'd like a male." And we've been a female only household for a long time with our canines. And so it took some prodding and some begging with the lady I live with. And she agreed to it. And so we are going through having two that are essentially 10 days apart in age. We refer to them as the buddies. So I have Lottie, the Labrador Retriever. She's of the Fox Red version of Yellow. And then I have Bear, the American Cocker. And I don't know if dogs get smarter every time you get a new puppy, but these two seem smarter than my last couple when I remember raising puppies. So,
meaning like they're outsmarting you more than you remember?
No, they just seem to be learning faster. And maybe they came from the breeder more socialized and more challenged and everything, but they both came to us knowing how to sit. They both came to us knowing their names, for the most part. And they've been really easy. Now, they're high energy, go-go dogs. They both crate trained really, really easy. They both house trained really, really easy. Now, that said, if I brought them into your house, I'm not promising they're going to be house trained. You know what I mean? At this age. But at my house, they're house trained for the most part. So the advantage here is that they wear each other out. I mean, it's WrestleMania around my house all the time. That is one advantage of having them. And my son's going to graduate high school this year and be off to try and extend his hockey career. And my daughter gets her driver's license in the spring. And this will be this is the first season in 9 years I haven't been a head coach of a youth hockey team. I'm assistant coach on our girls travel team. And next year I won't be coaching, so I will have a lot more time to really dedicate to it. And I guess if I'm going to train one, might as well train two. But the opportunity came is that it might have been 4 or 5 more years before the right American Cocker breeding came along again. And so I jumped in, and sometimes I think I'm crazy, but this really sets me up for the next decade of my life by having two kind of in their prime. And so this will take me through, till my current 6-year-old is, and she just turned six, but till River is pretty much retired, I'll be in pretty good shape with two dogs in their prime. Assuming they're going to make it, I've never washed one out. They give no indication right now. They both retrieve dead birds. It might not be a fully polished retrieve. I've started the gun breaking process, and I'm starting to really look forward to some woods walks this spring. I think having a 7 or 8 month old in the spring is really a nice age to be able to take them out when the cover's not super, super heavy. They can see you, you can see them, but there's also, you know, returning woodcock. There's also some birds around. And then at various times, depending on vacations and schedules and work, I'll farm them out for a month here or there. I know I told a mutual trainer buddy of ours that lives downstate that to hold me a spot in the spring for at least one of them. But it'll be interesting to see how they mature alongside each other. You know, who's ahead in certain areas, who's behind in certain areas. And they are completely two different breeds. And I learned from the last Cocker that you can't train them like a Labrador. So, but we'll see. This one seems maybe a little bit more bold and confident than Pippa was, you know, at this age. So, and I was looking for a male. I was looking for to get the biggest, strongest, you know, version of that breed that I could.
I was going to ask about kind of the decision to go male.
Yeah, her dad was like 35 pounds. I'll text you a picture of him. Just a striking, good-looking individual. And then her mom was 30. So Pippa was, you know, 24 pounds. And there is a point of diminishing return on size, especially when they're not real low to, when they're lower to the ground.
When you got Pippa, was she bound to be a hunting dog, or was that more of an experiment? I feel like I don't recall exactly, but.
Well, Carrie, that was supposed to be our dedicated 100% indoor dog that Carrie wanted. And this was my attempt to avoid getting a foo-foo dog.
A totally non-hunting dog. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And she really wanted, I don't want to say she wanted nothing to do with it, but you know, she was raised with a bunch of heathen Labradors, and there was no doubt in my mind that she just thought she was a Labrador. You know, she swam, she water retrieved. She just was convinced, and she, and that dog, one of her faults was, and I broke her of a few of them, but she just wanted to hunt whatever was there. I broke her of hunting rabbits. But if there was a squirrel or a chipmunk in the yard, you know, my labs just ignore it. She wanted to hunt it. I had to break her of deer chasing more than once that, you know, typically with the labs, it just takes one pretty good poke with the deer. And so she was supposed to be that. And then she just turned in. She just totally bonded to me and turned into, you know, 100% hunting dog, which led to my wife getting a Yorkie Maltese mix named Ted. Yeah, that's what happened there. So, but I wanted a dog that could hunt some. And then Harrison was getting to that age where, you know, maybe a little bit, but it didn't. She just thought she was a Labrador, other than she weighed 25 pounds and they weighed 50.
You said something interesting that you kind of learned that with Pippa, you had to train her differently than a lab. What are some of the differences?
I'll take an example. So you take a 6-month-old Labrador that wants to come in the back door and you slam the door with mistiming and they get hit in the head and they look at you like they're sorry. You know, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, let me in. I remember shutting the door and on Pippa and it just kind of nicked her toe. And for the next 3 weeks, she would look at me like, I'm not going through that door. You know what I mean? And so then when it came, she learned very much environmentally more than the Labradors did. And so you can drill a Labrador pretty hard. They want to work. They want to work. And they want to please so much. Where Pippa, you had to more or less convince her that it was kind of her idea. It was never she was always super birdie and super gamey and super aggressive. You know, it wasn't that kind of issues. It was, I had to take my time very differently gun breaking her. I had to think very differently about obedience. I know that There's a big Cocker guy up in the UP. I asked him a lot of it. He gave me some really, really good advice. And I had to let them just grow up. I had to let her grow up and mature. She matured a lot slower than the Labradors as far as obedience training. And with flushing dogs, you know, obedience kills a lot of birds. I want them on that ragged edge, but they got to have an ear tuned to me. And there's got to be important times where I can stop them with the whistle. I can direct them. And Pippa was the kind of dog where, you know, a lot of labs, you can throw them 25 retrieves and they just want more and more and more. I don't think that's what's best for them when they're little. I think you give them two or three and then leave them wanting more. With Pippa, she would retrieve a bumper once and then be bored with it. You know, so you lose some of your ability to train other aspects through the possessiveness of the Labrador. I like really possessive dogs because you can train them in a sense that the reward is something in their mouth. Where with her, you had to convince her that it was in her best benefit or her idea to be obedient. If that makes sense.
Yeah, a little different incentive structure with her versus the pure workmanship working dog lab. Just kind of what's next.
Right, what's next? And the biggest, you know, overall the biggest difference is the labs, my labs have just been far more forgiving of mistakes, of training mistakes or timing of training mistakes. And we all make them, don't tell me you don't. But then Pippa was. She was not overly forgiving. And then if I made a mistake, I'd have to leave it alone for 3-4 days and let her forget about it, where the labs just have such a short memory on that type of stuff. So, you know, Rick and I finally got her 100% broke, gun broke, by essentially taking her hunting someplace she really wanted to be. And because when I was trying to do it the traditional way I would do with the Labradors and at kind of traditional ages, she wasn't gun shy. I never had that issue. She just would kind of shut down a little bit when it came to some gun breaking. And then when she really learned, oh, these guns go with these grouse and these woodcock, then we were off to the races and, you know, never had an issue again, you know. But some of the traditional working on marking with her, you had to really think outside the box, trying to work on retrieve handling to a degree. You had to work outside the box. The nice thing is as far as like pattern and range, she came pretty programmed on that. And then I'm a big believer that just exposure and not too much control at a young age will really develop a better grouse type of pattern hunting from your flushing dog than traditional windshield wiper quartering training. So, just different timelines. You had to think differently about her. For the first time in my career, I used place boards with her. Where in the past with the Labradors, I never did. I'm doing that with both of them now. I think the benefit to it is just tremendous.
Yeah. Actually, I was reading in the Gundog magazine this morning and there was an article in there from Jeremy Moore about place training. And I knew that I was going to be talking to you today, and I wanted to ask if that was something that you do. Like, do you do actual place training, sit on that bed and stay there?
Yeah, I think it's really, really important. And then I've also evolved where I am. Some of it's the weather and their age right now, but I use the table now, and I'm using the training table for not force fetch. I don't expect to have, I will force fetch the Labrador, and it's more about learning to turn pressure on and pressure off and everything else than it is that I don't think I need a force fetcher to get her to reliably retrieve to hand or even present it at heel and sit. But I'm going through the training table right now just on basic obedience, recall from one end of the table to the other, sit from one end of the table to the other. Puppy retrieves on the table, you know, just introduction of that. And so I think I'm better as a trainer, and I've taken all the mistakes and tricks I've learned through the years and trying to apply what I would do different here and there. I do take some notes you know, when they're younger about certain ages and where we're at. And so I'm doing a lot of work on the table right now, but I can't do a lot of work outside. I know I'm getting ready to snowblow a retrieving corridor in my backyard, though, because they're getting to that age where their favorite game is keep away. And it's keep away, not just when I'm doing little puppy retrieves. It's just keep away from, like, hey, you need to go in your crate, or hey, you need to go here.
Catch me first.
Pretty soon, I'm going to put a crate without a door on it on the end of my table and make sure it's secure. I think I'm going to take two saw horses, put it at the end of my table, ratchet strap a crate to it, and then I'm going to start, because I mean, right now I can't say kennel and on their own, they go in the kennel, right? Every time I put them in a crate, I say kennel, but I'm going to start that process on the table here pretty soon. I'm super excited for the kind of the next stage of my life. And while I'll miss coaching and I'll miss being on the road with the kids, I'm excited to get back after it. You know, there was a time in my life I was grouse hunting or bird hunting 75 days a year, and I'm down to like typical year 35 to 40 now. And I know a lot of people are listening going, well, holy moly, but I just want to remind them some of those 35 to 40 days are 2 hours after work, right? Or I'm at a hockey tournament in this town and I ask somebody to take my kid for 4 hours between games so I can go run two spots.
You're going to have a little different program next year. That's for sure.
And I'm going to have an excuse that I need to go find areas with a bunch of birds and it to get these dogs into them. You know, I got friends in Kansas right now. They're having a great time, and I'm going to be able to accept some of those invites.
That's going
to
be good. And before we hit record, you mentioned camper. So I'm going to ask you about that before we sign off. But I don't want to leave the dogs yet.
Okay.
I kind of forgot how young they were this fall. So did you do puppy walks or like gunless puppy walks? I mean, what did that look like from how old are they? They were four months old or something.
Yeah, let's just say they were both born August 1st. Yeah, so they're 4.5 months old. So they were around, you know, during the season, they were around, you know, 8 to 12 weeks old. I do a puppy walk at least 5 days a week. And right now, we've stuck to a pretty strict routine of making sure that they're getting individual time also, not just always together. So yesterday after they had serious play time, I think I posted a picture or texted you a picture of the cocker, and my daughter's got him wrapped up in a great big beach towel because he's wet and snowballs stuck to him and everything. And then so, you know, he got an hour with us while the Labrador was in her crate, and then she came in and got an hour with us. And then they get time together. But I would do every day I went out hunting, they went with me. I'm a big believer in that. That's just more socialization, more noise, more everything. Riding in the truck, you know, learning how to calm, you know, be calm in our crate. And so I would get done with a spot and I would put one of them down and then have to shut the tailgate so the other one would stop crying and yelling and barking. And we would just go for a little puppy walk. And that's not just down a two track. That's me getting into cover with them. And, you know, the first, when they're 9 weeks old, they're kind of just hopping right along next to you. And I'm just walking at a slow pace in 10 minutes. And then we turn around and go back. And then I'm fortunate. I've talked in the past that, you know, Carrie and I live on a little bit of acreage and I've had a little bit of forest management done there. And so when I don't have the time, and you know, puppy walks are kind of survival of raising a puppy too, Nick, right? You know, they need, I don't think you should, I don't think it's healthy for a puppy's joints to be running them for an hour, but 10 to 12 minutes will wear out a 9 to 15 week old puppy pretty fast. And so at my house, I'll do little puppy walks and then I'll hide a bumper with a wing on it, you know, or do some of those, or in my yard, I'll do a drag drill just when they're little, and they think it's fun, but I'm just building on their natural instincts. I would say that as I've evolved as a trainer, I'm not in as big a hurry to get the obedience laid down, and I'm more in a hurry to get socialization done. And that's not just socialization to humans, that's socialization to a lot of different environments.
Yeah, just exposure to all the different things that you're going to be doing with them.
Right. So I've started the gun breaking process a little bit with just 22 acorn blanks. And the nicest thing about having an older dog is I can chuck a bumper, and when they're in full pursuit of the older dog chasing the bumper, you know, I can start to get some gun breaking. So that's gone pretty well with both of them so far. But no, puppy walks every day, and I'm struggling right now because, you know, both days this weekend I parked in an area where I knew I could park and there was a low probability of a snowmobile, but there had been some snowmobile traffic. And so this time of the year with the weather, I am running them together. But yeah, we went for a walk just because they're a lot easier to live with and they want it, right? Instead of just, and my wife was decorating the tree. And I don't know if you've ever had a puppy when your wife's trying to decorate a tree and has presents hanging out, but there's those fun memories and challenges too, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm going to be, hopefully if all goes according to plan, I will be reminded of all that puppy stuff next spring and summer.
You got one on the horizon? You got a deposit down?
Yep, deposit's in, and I'm committed. So at this point, I'm just waiting to, at some point here, Northwoods Bird Dogs, they'll announce the litters and kind of see where things shake out on the list and stuff. But yeah, we're going to get another one next spring.
Will they be related to Hartley or Rose?
Probably in some way. I know the sire that both my dogs are out of. Rose might have been out of his last litter, so he's gone. But as soon as the litters come out and I find out what I have a choice at, we'll see. But they'll probably be something similar in the same kennel and everything. So
right. But you're not looking for a bigger running, a closer, a different size. You're just trusting Northwoods.
I am, but that's a good point. I will be kind of when those litters are announced, I'll be calling Jerry because I want to get his thoughts, just as far as like I would take basically a carbon copy of Rose right now. I just like what I've seen out of her and what we've done, you know, my big level up and trainer from dog one to dog two, just like what Rose got exposed to. Like, I don't know how much is nature versus nurture and how unique she is, but I'm very, very happy with her. So I will be asking him, like, and I've talked to him before, you know, and there's obviously no guarantee, like you can't just, you know, pop out another one, but if there's any chance to kind of steer in that direction, I'm going to be very interested in that. I would actually say from a range perspective, like Rose is probably, I mean, she's about as big a running dog as I would really want. And she's very connected to me. So like I'm never really searching for her, but she's so fast. She can just cover ground so quickly. I mean, she can be 250 yards away, and she doesn't do that all the time, but she can just get out there so quickly. And the way she finds birds, like there's a lot of times where she goes on point a long ways away. And if she does that a lot, it starts to feel really inefficient. Cause it's like, man, I'm walking through 250 yards that, you know, Fritz's dogs would be vacuuming this up right here. But when you walk in and flush a grouse and, you know, it kind of makes it better, but it's the,
isn't it nice though, Nick, to have different horses for different courses? Like you can pick the right spot for Rose and you know, Hartley's still hunting hard. I know he had an injury, but you can put Hartley in some smaller spots and put Rose in some bigger spots.
Totally. Yep. And this year more than anything, because this year I saw the biggest drop off in Hartley's ability, just kind of slowing down a little bit. So this year more than any before this, I was really thinking about, okay, I'm going to get my big hike in with Rose, and Hartley and I are going to go work this objective, and hopefully we're going to get a chance at our bird. I mean, I have memories over both dogs again, another season. I mean, it's all good stuff, but I'm really excited. And especially with the ages of my two boys, we're all, as a family, we're all getting really excited for a puppy next spring.
You know, what's crazy is I even do that with the flushing dogs, right? Having Pippa and having, the labs, where the labs just naturally cover a lot more ground. And so I pick spots based on them. I did miss Pippa at times this season, you know, with hot, dry conditions and a little bit of flighty birds, you know, just a little bit more methodical, slower working dog in some areas really benefits me. But just like a harder charging cover more ground flushing dog works better in other spots, you know.
I was going to ask you earlier when you were talking about kind of the heat and stuff. I know you guys have, you know, you have cedar swamps that you can, like, do you kind of, and when it's hot, do you look for cedar for cooler, darker, wetter stuff? Or
yeah,
what do you try to do when it is real hot like that?
You know, I think I'm getting to the age where if it's just too hot, I don't want to hunt too much. You know what I mean? And so, but I do, it's just natural that around us and pretty much everywhere I've been in the Great Lakes, rough grouse ranges, the best spots seem to be at times pretty adjacent to water. And so when it is hot, of course, I'm going to pick a riverbank or a lake edge or an area that's got a low spot in it. I've been lost in a couple of cedar swamps, and so I'm never walking into one again. Not just that I'm worried about getting lost, but they are not fun with the blowdowns and everything to try and, oh, we walk to the back of this and we'll just cut through the cedar swamp to get back. Well, it just cost you double the amount of time that it would have if you just, you know, walked out the other way. But I do try and pick those spots. I don't think that, you know, if it's 68 degrees in the aspen and in the ferns and it's 65 degrees, you know, on the edge of a swamp, I don't think that makes too big a difference. So it's carry extra water, plan to, you know, give it 25 or 30 minutes of hell and then get out of there, get the dogs cooled down and go. You know, the humidity is as big a thing as it is the heat is what I've noticed. I mean, if you get a 66 degree day with low humidity, they hunt way different than they do on a 66 degree day with high humidity. You can just observe the amount of panting and everything else they're doing.
You know, again, you're not a guide. You're not an outfitter. You know, you don't have to go. It's nice when you don't have to push it like that, but it's tough when you have an early season like we did this year. That was, you're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And you know how short that primetime window can be.
I really marvel at the guys that have really heat tolerant dogs. And you know, I'm hunting Labradors that can sit in a duck boat in 25 degree weather and break ice too. And I, you know, my dogs tend to, I think they adjust their coats for what they're doing. And I mean, the amount of shedding I had this fall was tremendous. It's kind of a surprise, but you know, I just, you know, I admire guys that are willing to be out there when it's 75 degrees and they've got a dog that can handle it. That's just not that I don't personally want to be out when it's 75 degrees,
especially not if the mosquitoes are out.
You know, I'm fortunate that I can kind of go, well, the weather's not right. I'm going to get all my work done, my chores done and everything. And I'm going to save days for when it's really good and then be able to go.
First world problem, but yeah, I guess I appreciate having that flexibility as well,
right,
to kind of go when it makes the most sense. But
right,
what are the odds you think you'll have a rough grouse drumming on the snowbank in the spring?
I don't know. I cut that. We had that area clear cut at our house, so yeah, it might maybe on the other side of my property if we're gonna have one, but. You know, we've talked for years. I live about, I don't know, half a mile from some marginal grouse habitat. And the years, I can almost tell you whether we're going to have a good season or not by the number of birds I see at my house in the spring, when they start to disperse in the spring to mate, and then again in the fall shuffle. And I did, I saw one grouse opening day in my driveway, and I have not seen one since. But now I cut down a pretty 2 acres of jack pines that we traditionally had them in, and so that's starting to regenerate. I'm starting to actually get some aspen in there, but it's going to come back in some white pine and aspen and probably some maple. So kind of my little pocket that they would move, you know, the islands of cover they move to has been clear cut. So I don't know if I'll see one there this year or not. I was fortunate to acquire some recreational land south of me. So I'm in the process right now I actually talked to the surveyor this morning. Once that surveyor's done, I have had the forestry prescription written for it, and it'll go out to bid this spring to get cut. And it's been fun kind of working on that. I'm going to see how many grouse I can grow on that amount of acres. So it's right down to one drumming log for every 3 acres that's at least 12 inches in diameter and 12 feet long. And I'm going to do some wildlife planning, but I'm thinking that I'm going to start this spring and do my own drumming survey on my own recreational property and, you know, pick consistent dates and times and see what's there. There's a few birds on it right now. There's a small river that runs right through the middle of it, and there's a lot of alder down there, and then there's quite a bit of habitat on the adjacent parcels. So I did find some birds there. I don't know if I'll ever even hunt it, to be honest with you. But it sure will be nice to set up for dog training and to play around with. And
never known you to be like a deer hunter or anything. Is it really just kind of a fun project for you? You're going to be chasing deer and turkey there?
No, I'm not a deer hunter, but I do have some cameras set up, and I believe that there's some family members that are interested.
Okay.
So I think Harrison probably at some point will be interested. And I think that Rick's kid, who's in love with that type of stuff, is going to be interested. His grandfather just gave him a deer rifle. So.
Oh, okay. Awesome. That's cool, man. That's that is definitely a.
I had a couple really nice bucks, and I'm guessing after I cut it. Yeah. Even better at some point, you know, they like the same type of habitat. But to have the trout stream running through the middle of it. I asked for half a dozen wood duck boxes for Christmas. So I'm going to hang some wood duck boxes on it. And
that's fun. That's definitely a goal of mine. I hope to own some land someday to be able to do those kinds of things. It's just fun.
Yeah. And I'm going to, you know, once it gets clear cut and starts to regen, I'm going to bring in a forest mulching machine. And, you know, the forester and the wildlife plan really laid it out pretty well about, you know, some wildlife openings and what you're going to plant. I'm going to plant, you know, a couple small spruce groves. The only thing missing is one giant oak tree on it.
Are there any oaks on it?
There's not a single oak on that thing. No, it's mostly aspen and white pine. Some maple.
You got to get to the gym here. We got to let you run pretty quick, but I teased it earlier. You mentioned a camper, and I've learned that the listeners love the camper and the truck and the rig stuff. So, I don't know where you are in the research phase, but are you looking at anything specifically?
Here's what I've decided. Small enough that I can handle on my own. What I think is 3-season. I want, for lack of a better term, double axle and a little bit more ground clearance. So I'm heavy in research mode. I haven't gotten this approved on the home front, but I'm thinking very seriously about it. As most people know, I work in the hotel business, and the thought of having something my own and being able to put my own mattress in, be able to set up the way I want. I know I'm looking in that 22 to 24 bunkhouse range. I personally will be happier if I go to the UP and can pull into a campground and spend $30 to $50 a night than I would be pulling into the UP and renting a motel room for 3 nights. That's just me personally. I like my own space. I'm excited about it if I can get it approved, but I'm in deep research stage right now. I know I'm going to get a bunkhouse also. So I want it small enough that I can kind of handle it pretty easily on my own. But I've got a number of friends that have gone the camper route, and they just couldn't be happier. They get the Starlink. One of the advantages is, you know, you're in a hotel room. The idea of me, let's say I'm going to go to the UP for a week. I can take my camper and I can get up and have my computer and my printer and my Starlink, and I can sit at, you know, the little dinette table and have a window and be parked where I'm parked. Versus my discipline to sit in a motel room at the whatever desk is not going to be the same if I need to crank out 3 hours of work because I'm going to go hunt in the afternoon. And I just like having my own space. And some of them say one of the nicest things is They can pack it and organize it and set it up. Instead of getting to a motel, they don't have to unpack it.
Yeah, just the shuffling stuff around is just enough to kind of be friction where, you know, you're going to be less efficient.
Right. And then, you know, maybe as we start to enter empty nester life, you know, maybe in the summer, the wife wants to go places for a weekend or do something. I mean, we spend so much of our time at the lake, but quite frankly, that's where we want to be right now. But when you go from having limited summer weekends to a broader openness, then maybe she wants to go some places. So we'll see. I'm heavy in the research phase. I just know how happy my buddies are that have gotten them. And, you know, they've got their own place, you know, their own setup. I know, you know, some of them rent a slot in a campground for a month in certain areas, and the flexibility to just be able to hook up and go, you know, to be at a campground where you can stake your dogs out instead of being at a motel where you never know what the dog stakeout situation is going to be.
I'm not really there right now, but it definitely, that seems more my style. And again, I know I've heard from many, many listeners. And again, if you go that route and you're excited about it, you're probably more likely to email nick@birdshotpodcast.com. But I've heard from plenty of people that love it. So
I'm in heavy research mode right now. I'll text you the one I'm looking at. But, you know, enough of a bunkhouse that, you know, if I've got buddy and a kid, you know, we're okay, right?
Awesome, buddy. Well, this has been a blast. I appreciate it as always. Thank you for taking some time for me and the listeners. And you got exciting stuff ahead of you with those young dogs, and I'm happy for you.
Yeah, you might end up having to see me more often.
Well, yep. Come on over and I'll check out that camper and we'll go chase some birds, buddy.
All right. Thanks, Nick.
All right. Thanks again, Fritz. Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.